Good afternoon. What did they say? Every challenge is an opportunity. It's lovely to be here. My name is Ewan Kelly and I'm from Scotland. It's lovely to be in a beautiful place, but it's lovely to be in a beautiful warm place where you know it will be warm tomorrow. That doesn't happen very often in Scotland. My background is in medicine and then in healthcare chaplaincy, and I've done some work around ritual. And I want to suggest to you that healthcare is heavily ritualised. And it was lovely hearing Parr's presentation, because there are many touchstones with the two presentations. And really what I want to explore is the ritual dance, if you like, between patient and practitioner, but not just with individuals, but within teams and systems, and the significance of ritual for healthcare and keeping healthcare human. And at the core of what Parr was talking was meaning and purpose, and that's what ritual's about, whether we're religious or not. All rituals are contextual. This guy is John Knox. He was a follower of John Calvin, and he stands outside the Divinity Faculty where I teach in Edinburgh, so rather than posing. He's responsible for not just a lot of our religious observance and how it's been informed over the years in Scotland, but also education. And he's certainly informed the way we understand ritual in Scotland. So the important point for me in all of this is ritual is contextual. And our practice is always contextual, whatever healthcare discipline we represent. And that's very important before we start. What's also very important is that ritual emerges out of stories. Stories, individual stories, family stories, community stories. Ritual happens when stories meet together. And out of that comes something new and something unique. So I want to talk a little bit about the background to ritual. I want to talk a little bit about the work that I've done. Every academic likes to talk about their own work, so I'd like to do that for about 20 minutes. And then what I'd like to do is to postulate and perhaps provoke some questions and thinking in you about your practice or your work in terms of the role of ritual in healthcare today. Certainly, and in my context in the UK, it may be different, of course, in your context. I've just had a fantastic week in Gozo. If you get a chance on Sunday to go to Gozo and you've never been, go to Gozo. And some of the most earliest prehistoric remains that have been recorded are in Gozo. And there's evidence there of ritual being performed, marking life and death, up to almost 4,000 years before BC, before the birth of Christ. Ritual's been around in Egypt for a long time too, and Peter the Cartoon says he changed his mind, he wants to be cremated. Marking life and death ritually has been significant for the human race ever since time began. And also in ancient China. The meaning of ritual is deep indeed. He who enters it with the kind of perception that distinguishes hard and white, same and different, will drown there. The meaning of ritual is great indeed. He who tries to enter it with the uncouth and inane, theories of the system makers will perish there. The meaning of ritual is lofty indeed. He who tries to enter with the violent, arrogant ways of those who despise common customs and consider themselves to be above other men and women will meet his or her downfall there. So this stuff is complex, and it's significant. And human beings for thousands of years have recognised that. To try to define it is a bit more challenging. It's a bit like spirituality. It's rather elusive. But here's some aspects of ritual. Ritual fulfills a deep need. A deep need, a visceral need, not just a cerebral need. for the deep need for individuals, families and communities in relation to themselves, to other people and for many to God, especially in times of liminality, times of transition and uncertainty. And rituals, in many ways, what they do in times of transition and liminality is to reaffirm a sense of belonging, to reaffirm social ties, to mark changes in identity, to generate meaning or to seek meaning. And all of that helps to foster a sense of solidarity and to help us to manage crisis in life. For Anderson and Foley, two pastoral theologians from the States, ritual is ordered, patterned, and shared behaviour. But more than that, it's imaginative and an interpretive act, an embodied act, through which we express and create meaning in our lives. So ritual is performative. Ritual is embodied. It emerges out of the story or the meeting of stories of individuals and communities. It's interpretive and it's invested with meaning. I would suggest that we are doing ritual now. Or perhaps what we're doing is co-constructing ritual. It's performative. I'm performing. It's embodied. We all live in bodies. It evolves out of my story and my understandings, but your interpretation of what you hear is informed deeply by your story, by your values, beliefs, and experience. And I hope it has some meaning for both of us. I hope. This is crucial. When I get up in the morning, what I do is I wash first, I shave, I then put my clothes on, and then I have my breakfast. I do that every morning. For me, that's not a ritual, that's routine. What makes routine become ritual? Well, it's what we invest, it's our intention in the action. It's our intention, our shared or our individual intention. And this, I think, is crucial for us in healthcare. Because what happens if we have one person who's performing an act that they think is routine, i.e. the healthcare practitioner, and another, i.e. the patient or relative, who considers this embodied act as a ritual, something that they've invested a huge amount of meaning. So my area of research and interest in this particular paper was around baby death and ritual. So many of us here will be parents or grandparents, uncles or aunties, and we've washed and dressed a baby. And for those of us who've had to do that hundreds of times under different circumstances and during the middle of the night, I'm not sure how much meaning that was invested for with me. But when you do that once, and only once, and when your baby has died, and you're investing that, what sort of meaning might you be investing in that? What might be considered a performative act that's routine in normal life becomes a very profound ritual action. I believe healthcare is infused with ritual. Part of our discussion was around end of life, a very ritualized time in our lives, like end of life and death. But potentially every therapeutic encounter is a co-constructed ritual between two individuals or more, which is an embodied act where two stories meet, or multiple stories meet, and new meanings can be found for both parties. And they can both be invested by the intention of the practitioner and the intention of the patient. What about the encounters that we have with colleagues at handovers or team meetings? Are they routine or are they ritual? What about our professions, our education, our training? What about the Hippocratic Oath? What about our graduation? What about the institutions that we work for? What rituals do we have? What about those of us who sit on board meetings where big decisions are made about finance and how that's going to be cut up? Is that a routine? Or is that a performative act that's informed with multiple meanings? And what about the systems that we embody? Healthcare systems. Do they have rituals? Or are they in danger of routinization, of routine, of creating routine rather than ritual? Taking the meaning out of what we do, and I want to talk a bit more about that. And that is happening in the UK, and I want to talk about that. Traditionally, as I say, ritual and healthcare has been linked with transition and liminality, with times of birth, during illness, dying and death. That traditionally, that's when the healthcare expert or the religious expert was brought in. And Farr referred to the fact that we're moving away from a transactional attitude to healthcare to a more personalised one. I wonder to what extent we still do to patients rather than with them. So, to what extent are the rituals we perform done to people or with people? And that's where I think it's important around how we construct or reconstruct or co-construct rituals within our healthcare systems. So as a junior doctor, I was taught to be competent. I was taught to examine everybody the same way, to be a safe, competent practitioner. I listened to them to hear their story. I then examined them, made a differential diagnosis and suggested investigations. Was that for me a ritual? It certainly was for the people that I examined. What about last offices? Those of us who are in the nursing profession, and some would argue in the medical profession. How do we deal with the death of a patient? And how do we treat that patient once they die? Is that routine? Or is that a ritual? And what's the impact, not just on the patient and their family, but on us, if that no longer becomes a ritual, or is a ritual for us? Okay, a wee bit about the work I did with bereaved parents. I was fortunate enough to be a chaplain in two large teaching hospitals in Scotland, where a lot of my work was in maternity units. And while I was working as a chaplain, I wondered really about what the impact of my practice was on patients, on parents and on grandparents and uncles and aunties. And a lot of that practice was around ritual, either ritual in labour suite or ritual at a graveside or in a crematorium. In urban Scotland, the vast majority of not just babies but adults are cremated, and that's informed by our religious perspective as well. So I was hoping to understand the role of ritual in parental grief. I wanted to understand the importance of the content and the way the ritual was constructed, and what was the significance of involving chaplains in that. Scotland is not as religious a place or a country as Malta or America. Our last census was 3 years ago, and 98% said they had some sort of religious affiliation. But actually, in fact, probably the figures here from 2001, probably it's nearer 7 or 8% of people in Scotland will attend worship regularly, and about two-thirds profess to believe in a God, and less than half in an afterlife. In postmodern Scotland, people believe in something, but they don't belong. The research I was doing was qualitative. I was trying to find out the lived experience of parents by interviewing them in their own front room. I interviewed 30 parents, and one mother contributed in writing. Their babies had died either up to term, 40 weeks gestation, from 16 weeks. And the interviews were recorded and transcribed. Of the participants, they were very postmodern Scotland. None of them were active worshippers. So these were people who had worked with a colleague of mine, a chaplain. They hadn't asked necessarily to see the chaplain, but they certainly hadn't asked to see their own priest or their own minister or their own religious leader. 25% of them said they had some sort of religious affiliation, but none of them were actively involved. None of them actively worshipped. 50% of them roughly had an affiliation as a child, and 50% had no affiliation at all. What I was doing was really reflecting through qualitative research on the practice of my colleagues who were kind enough to agree to that. In fact, one of my colleagues is here today, Ian Telfer. So the practice of four chaplains, three who were Presbyterians, and one was a Roman Catholic. And that was fantastic because we all worked together on this. Our practice was very similar. What was really interesting is the vast majority of these parents would not have seen a chaplain unless the midwife looking after them had said something like, "They're not what you think they are. They're actually really human." And it's in my experience that those parents who have worked with a chaplain benefit. So the midwives were acting as a gatekeeper, and this is really important. What my colleagues, what we did as a department, the way we worked was we were involved in a process of co-construction of ritual. So each ritual was unique. And it was a combination of the chaplain's story and all that informed the chaplain's story, meeting with the parent's story. So it wasn't pretending that we didn't have a faith background, but it was actually starting where the parents were at. Not where we assumed they were at, or where we wanted them to be at, but listening to their story. So the process of constructing a ritual, this is at a gravesite or a funeral, was very much like this. Sometimes in a maternity unit or in a delivery suite, there wasn't as much chance to do some co-construction. But the idea was giving people informed choice where they wanted it. So it was giving them information, the information that they needed to be able to create their ritual for their baby. We were very clear, the ritual belonged to the family. It didn't belong to the chaplain. It didn't belong to the hospital. It didn't belong to any religion. It belonged to the parents. What they believed and what they wanted. And what we did was we offered them both sacred, that is, religious texts, religious readings, prayers, and secular poems and prose. So we offered both. And then we offered them participation in ritual. Did they want to be involved? Did they want to act out their relationship with their baby in the ritual? So did they want to write something? Did they want to bring something? Or did they want to carry their baby's coffin, to hold their baby, or to lower their baby into the grave? And then, crucially, they were given time. And then they were given more time. And then they were given more time indeed. And then it was checked out with the parents what they wanted, and that often changed. And that was part of the risk. And that's really important in this process of risk, of giving power over to other people. We'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. And once that was agreed, the ritual was shared. And sometimes the ritual wasn't agreed until the folk folks actually arrived at the funeral because they changed their mind. And that again was part of the risk. So what were some of the issues that these mums and dads were facing? Well, the first one was social isolation. It was that kind of thing, people crossed the road. People didn't know what to say to them, even in their own families or when they returned to work. They didn't know, they felt on their own. And it's very interesting, I think if I was doing the study now, I think far more people now feel that they're in touch with other bereaved parents through the internet. And that's even in 5 years' time. Well, more than 5 years now. What they found was what they described as a loss of meaning and purpose. The huge focus in their life had been taken away from them. And some of these families were folks who'd been, they'd been trying for babies for a long time, and they'd had medical intervention to help them. And there was one woman, out of the 17 women who I was in contact with, there was one woman who had suicidal ideation. There was a complete lack of control. One mum and dad described themselves going into a black hole and not knowing how to get out. Just completely disorientated. And very sadly, people felt a huge lack of self-worth, of guilt, of not being able to create and take the term. And that, interestingly enough, wasn't just mums, but also dads too. They felt responsible in their own way. What they said was that the ritual marking of participating in a ritual, either in the delivery suite with a name and address in, or at the graveside, or in the crematorium, helped social integration. That people understood a funeral or a blessing. It was a conversation topic, it's something they could talk about at work, that their baby had a funeral. And what that also indicated to the folks at work or the family, how important the baby was to them, even though the baby died mid-term. What it also gave the folks opportunity to do is actually to be a parent, to make decisions, to construct something, to take part in something, to do their very best for their baby. In a way that they couldn't, where normal parenting wasn't available. It also helped them to regain control, and I'll come back to that, that it helped them to do something, where everything had gone out of control, they could make decisions for their baby, but also for themselves. It also gave them a sense of order, so the whole thing about ritual marking, any of you who've gone through bereavement yourself, all the evidence is that rituals give us a sense of order at a time where everything seems upside down and back to front. It also confronted mums and dads with the terrible reality of what happened. Seeing their baby, holding their baby, and seeing the coffin, having a funeral. They maybe only then began to start to grieve, but they actually had memories to which they could grieve over. What it also did for others was to validate their grief that they weren't going crazy. So they would tell their story, and then during the ritual, the chaplain would retell it, and they'd hear their own feelings back. So if someone in a position of authority says, that's how they felt, then it was okay to feel that way. The other thing that around that was validating grief was when we gave people resources that other parents had used, that this helped to them to describe their feelings, but also validated their grief. It also helped them to have memories and to have healing memories, cherished memories. One mum talked about the funeral being one of the most important and beautiful events in her life because she created something special for her baby. It was a healing memory at a time when some of the other memories were horrendous for families. This is really revealing. We touched on power and authority. One of our friends, Dr. Watts, mentioned power. When I asked parents what their assumptions about chaplains were, what they expected the chaplain to be like, He said they were going to be paternalistic. They were going to be detached, not actually get involved with me. The chaplain, they didn't expect the chaplain to be vulnerable, to actually get alongside them and listen, and actually be moved by what had happened. And they also expected the chaplain to, in our culture, to bang them over the head with a Bible, try and convert them. So that was why it was the midwives who acted as the gatekeepers. And that was crucial. So that whole practice of actually getting to know your colleagues in other disciplines who act as a gatekeeper. But authority was also important. So here we have something about, there's actually a paradox here, because authority and power was important because some people felt it was important that there was a chaplain. It was a representative of God or of the church who perform the ritual. Because after all, if your electricity goes, you get an electrician, and if your plumbing goes, you get a plumber. You want the right person for the right job. But more than that, for some parents, not for all, the prayers of a chaplain were perceived to have more efficacy. Whether the chaplains believed that or not didn't matter. But what a handful of parents very specifically said was that they handed their baby over to the chaplain, and the chaplain handed their baby over to God. That for me was, we say, gobsmacking. The power invested is so powerful. So really, what my learner colleague was saying is, half an hour ago, 40 minutes ago, was so true, I think, that for us in healthcare, we all have power and authority. It's how aware are we of that power and authority? How discerning, how self-aware are we to utilise it in the appropriate way? To use wisdom, what the Greeks called phronesis, to be aware of our learned and reflected experience from the past, to be aware of our knowledge, to use our values, our character, and our discernment in the present. Co-constructing ritual involves giving away power to enable other people to have power when they felt they didn't have any, if they wanted. This might not be for everybody. Just as the patient goes into the physician and said, "You're the expert, doc. You tell me what to do." But for the parents in this study, this was really important. It gave us back some control at a time when everything else was out of control. I always thought of priests, this must have been my Roman Catholic colleague, as important people, but somehow he stepped back. It was our ritual, not his. But paradoxically, parents also realised that during the ritual, the chaplain had authority to hold the space. To hold the space where they could be vulnerable. Where they could be as they needed to be. And yet what they all said was that it was so important that they could see that the chaplain, as well as having the power, had paradoxically vulnerability at the same time. So they didn't remember what the chaplain said, but they remembered how the chaplain was. Personalisation of rituals. Parents felt it was their ritual for their baby, and it was a way in which they could parent their baby at a time when they couldn't do anything else. So they wrote things, they said things, they chose music. They acted out their relationships. I'll talk about a bit more about that. But what this also did was healing, in that it was affirming of parents that they could create something at a time when they felt a failure, when they felt they couldn't create. They were involved in creating something unique and special. And here was somebody in authority, perceived authority, saying, you can do this if you want to. So the content was really about the telling or the retelling of the baby's story in the context of the family story and in the context of the divine story. Anderson and Foley talk about the weaving together of the human and the divine. I would also say that that's about embodying, or in theological language, incarnating the human and the divine. So the divine story wasn't always spoken, but it was embodied. And this is really significant because a lot of these parents said they weren't religious. But actually, when you offered them a choice of sacred texts, of prayers and poems, or prayers and bits of scripture, and hymns, and secular material, quite often the non-religious people would choose sacred stuff. So you'd have interviewing parents who'd say, I'm not religious, but we just talked about angels and my granny looking after my baby in heaven. It was fascinating. So what wasn't happening is people were telling people what to believe, and yet as you teased that out, there was a whole mixture, a whole raft of not traditional doctrine, but different beliefs which you could label as religious. Does that make sense? The powerful bit that they remember most was the enactment, the embodied interpretation. The bit that always makes me cry, and I'm just about there as I tell you this, is one dad who was a real working class Scots male who normally doesn't get emotional until he's had 5 pints of beer. I don't know if Maltese men are like that, but maybe different. But what he said was, what was so important that I could carry my boy into the crematorium because I was proud of him. But more than that, I wanted him to be proud of me. I carried my boy because I was proud to be his dad, and I wanted him to be proud that I wasn't. But also what was acted out was the relationship of God with God. And whether that was the making of the sign of the cross, or whether that was the cuddle that was given to mum and dad by the chaplain after the service, both were enacting out the divine story. So the key thing around here was what we talked about earlier was about the chaplain's personhood and character. And I think this is crucial for healthcare, that what impacts on patients, on families, and on each other is not just what we do, but how we do it. Our way of being, our way of relating, and our performing. So what is not just significant about any of us as speakers is what we say, it's how we say it. And the role of the chaplain was about accompaniment. It was about accompanying people on their journey. It was hearing their story of hurt and pain and loss and their hopes. But it was more than that. It was giving them information. It was perhaps giving them a structure to any ritual. It was using their knowledge. It was using their power in an appropriate way. I love Winnie the Pooh. I don't know how many of you know Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh is a bear who comes to the life in the mind of A.A. Milne. I used to read it to my kids, I think they got sick of it. But Winnie the Pooh, one of his best friends is a little pig called Piglet, and they're walking into the dark wood. They're journeying into the unknown, into the darkness, into the place of uncertainty. And here, Winnie the Pooh and Piglet are looking for what they call woozles. These are an imaginary animals. Winnie the Pooh is the parent and Piglet is the healthcare professional and the chaplain journeying with. It's Winnie the Pooh's journey into the darkness, into the unknown, into the scary places, not the healthcare professionals. It's the patient, it's the parent that sets the tone and the direction and the content of that journey. And there is a role, and that can be challenging for all sorts of reasons, for accompaniment. But it's not just about accompaniment. You see, Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, when they were following these tracks in the snow, trying to find the Woozles, what they were doing is going round in circles following their own tracks. To find their way forward in bereavement and in illness, people need those with knowledge and expertise to share information. But to share information at the right time and in the right way. So there's a need for that discernment again. To see a bigger picture. To see a way forward. And here, Christopher Robin, their friend, is up the tree. And he's able to see that they're going round in circles. And to show them a way out of the wood. So the role of the chaplain wasn't just about accompaniment. It was also about sharing knowledge and expertise, giving people informed choice at the right time and at the right pace. Just to finish, I've had the 10-minute warning. It's just some thoughts about bridging this gap. And I hope, I'm sure you have picked up flavours of what I'm about to say. About ritual and ritual construction. About power and risk. About how we go about the art of healthcare, not just the what and the science. The risk of de-ritualization and the importance of the ritual of reflective practice. So we've said that ritual is performative, it's embodied, it emerges out the meeting of stories, it's interpretive, and it's invested with meaning. Or is it routine? Or is it sometimes routine? Or is it just sometimes routine because we're human? Because we're tired? Because we're stressed? Because of all sorts of different reasons? Recently, I had a wee lump, and I got referred to go to the hospital for a test, an investigation. First of all, I was an hour late. That was fine. And then I was asked to go into a cubicle by a nurse who didn't introduce himself. I stuck out my hand and said, "I'm Ewan, Ewan Kelly," and he replied. He asked me to take my clothes off and lie down with a sheet over me. Just not a linen sheet, just paper sheet. And I lay there, and he popped his head round and said, "Doctor so-and-so's, he's not a bad lad, he's okay." He popped his head out again. 20 minutes later, the doctor came in and said, "Hello, I'm doctor." And I stood up, and unfortunately the sheet went down. But I took my hand out deliberately and said, "Hello, I'm Ewan Kelly, nice to meet you." He said, "I'm doctor, so and such and such." And then he did the investigation, and I said, "Can you tell me what you found, or what you're finding?" And he did. And he said, "Oh, by the way, 5% of the population walk around with those all the time, you'll be fine." And then he said, your GP will get a letter in a month's time. I still haven't heard from the GP, and he walked out. Now, I was a medic. Well, you can tell I like to talk. I'm a chaplain, I have power, I have authority. But not then. I didn't certainly feel empowered. I felt done to, not done with. And I certainly had no opportunity to co-construct something. He didn't ask me, "What do you like to be referred to? You know, are you Ewan?" He didn't actually ask me my name, to be honest. And I said, "Actually, well, you're calling yourself Dr. So-and-so. I'm actually Reverend Doctor." Doctor, actually. Because I said, "I've got a PhD and an MBC." I wonder what would have done, what would have happened to the power there. But actually at that point I was desperately trying to cover myself up. Oh. What's it like in the meetings in your healthcare institution? Do you do any co-construction on how it's meant to be run? Not just what's done. What about team dynamics? What about the ritual of that? Do you actually have team meetings? Do you have an opportunity to debrief? And what about the systems? It's really interesting because what I hope I've shown is how ritual is co-constructed and how it's performed has a huge impact on the outcome of parents. And I'd love to have done a more longitudinal study, but I'm not very good with figures and anyway. But what we do know is that patient experience is as important as safety and as clinical effectiveness on the outcome. Not the clinical outcome, but the patient outcome. As the person-centered outcome. You see, it's not just that parents can be healing memories. What's my memory like for my next encounter with a doctor or with a healthcare institution? Not just me, but my boys. I've got three boys. And my wife, who also happened to be there. And my father, who's got a melanoma. And I hope he told them that story. What's it like for the collective memory of my family the next time we have to engage with healthcare? Was that routine, or was that ritual? I know how it felt for me. I think it's a real danger for the well-being, not just of patients, but of staff. Thank you, 5 minutes to go. That we lose that investment of meaning and purpose, that dance that we talked about before, of the ritual of finding out where each other are and engaging on a human level before we get to the transactional. This is a lovely quote from a bit of work that was done by the King's Fund. If you've not discovered the King's Fund, I know there are equivalents in the States and there will be in other countries, but they do some lovely work on patient experience, patient outcomes. You just Google in the King's Fund. And this is a quote. Firth and Cousins of Cornwall were interviewing staff. And this is a young nurse. I went to work in an elderly ward where patients died daily and there was great pressure on beds. At first I did all I could to make the lead up to death have some meaning and to feel something when one of them died. But gradually the number of deaths and the need to strip down beds and get another patient in as fast as you can got to me. And I became numb to patients. It became just about the rate of turnover, nothing else. Routine, not ritual. Who's being affected there? A member of healthcare staff. And who then does that affect? But their patients. Some of you will be very familiar with the Francis Report. Very briefly, it was a report that was commissioned by the government in an area in a healthcare trust where there was a high level of morbidity and mortality in certain units. And what they found really was, I would call it a de-ritualisation of the system, but dehumanisation of healthcare staff. So the ritual of being admitted to hospital. So many of us, if not all of us, or we have a relative who's been admitted to hospital and we know what that's like. And here's one patient who was reprimanded by members of staff for calling his wife on the phone. When I was told to be admitted, I was left in a small cubicle for several hours on a trolley, no pillows, no blankets, and when I rang to tell my wife, I was admonished quite sharply by someone who told me to get a life and not to use the phone in hospital. Eventually I got a pillow, and then an hour later a blanket arrived, which I refused because it was covered in somebody else's blood. A ritual for the patient has become not even a routine. What is it that our systems do to people? At the moment, it's being proposed in England that registered nurses will only look after up to 8 patients because we're so understaffed in the UK. Finally, I'll find one final. Is that okay, sir?
Yeah, thank you.
The ritual of intentional reflective practice to keep us well in healthcare. And this is something that we've developed in Scotland that focuses on the meaning, it focuses on the how, it focuses on the vocational. And people are invited to share a case study of their practice, and together in a group, some of the questions that are considered, the focus isn't on the patient, the focus isn't what we did well and what did we do wrong and how can we learn from it, that's traditionally what we've done. The focus is on the practitioner. Whose need was met during that encounter, during that meeting, by this bit of education, by the way this organisation operates? What does it tell me about my ability to care? Not my competency, but my ability, my natural ability. What does it tell me about me and my values, my attitudes, my behaviours? And this is a crucial one. With whom did the power lie? Whose voices dominated or had most value? Whose voices were not heard or undervalued? We're in the middle of doing quite a large study across Scotland. This is being rolled out across the health service and the social care service in Scotland with government funding. But an initial pilot of 70 healthcare practitioners, regular participation in values-based reflective practice over 18 months, was shown to promote person-centred practice, to deepen relationships in teams, but even more important, to help people reconnect with meaning and purpose of work. Because all the evidence shows, another lecture, is that when we're able to work with meaning and purpose, it keeps us well and resilient. It's not the money we get paid or the lack of it that keeps us going when things are tough. It's actually living out our values and working with meaning and purpose. And I would say that as embodied people who are dealing with the meeting of stories in an intentional way and helping us all to interpret and perhaps to be transformed, that's all about ritual. And a really, really important ritual is play. So here's Winnie the Pooh and his friend. He says, I'm fed up on poo sticks, let's go down the arcade and get ourselves tattooed. An important part in ritual, in life and in healthcare, is learning to play and let go. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm Barb Elliott from Minnesota in the U.S.
Hi.
And among my jobs is that I work, my clinical work is as a chaplain at the hospital on call for crisis ministry overnight. It is a Roman Catholic facility, and so there is a expectation that every death will be attended by a chaplain, and so often I'm called into the wards to be with patients' families under those circumstances. But some of the things that you just described remind me how important that is for the staff. Because often when I'm called and there's no family, I'm there because the staff needs me. And that ritual creates a continuing community and meaning. So another example of what you have been describing. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a lovely example.
Could I ask a question?
Hi.
Hello, I'm Monica van Erhoven. I'm a medical oncologist from the Netherlands. Thanks for your very nice presentation. I was wondering, with this very, well, nice picture, whether play shouldn't be part of your definition of a ritual. And I was a bit puzzled about your example of the emergency, the guy in the emergency room. Because in that example, I think that not so much ritual was lacking, but simply good care.
I agree. I think plays really important. I think playfulness and creativity are part of practice. I think the most important thing, most important resource we have in healthcare is ourselves. And some of us have lost the ability to play. And that's about systems and culture, I think. Good care. But what you had was somebody coming in expecting good care. But what I was trying to get the point at is that coming to hospital is a ritual. It's a time of transition and liminality. It's a time of great fear. And the way I define ritual, about it being embodied, about it being interpretive, because at that time people are wondering all sorts of things, and they're bringing the stories of their family and relatives and the things they've seen on television to that moment, and they're wondering what the heck is going on with me. And they have expectations, and very often, unfortunately, in the systems that we have in Scotland and the UK, those expectations aren't met. And I think if we did have some sort of understanding about the investment in meaning that people bring at that point in their lives, I think we would then perhaps think more about care we provide. Does that help? Thank you.
I would like to share something. Thank you for your beautiful presentation. It was very moving, very beautiful. I work as a clinical psychologist in Norway, and I meet oftentimes health professionals, nurses, physiotherapists, a few medical doctors with severe panic attacks and depression because they lack meaning in their work. And have stopped with a nurse who, several nurses who are to care for elderly who are senile and want to talk with someone, but they only have 2 minutes to give a pill. Or another nurse was telling me, she's on sick leave, she was telling me, was working on a ward, had a person who needed a new liver, and there was a liver, but there was no bed, so the liver had to be thrown away. And this was, the issue here is not about spirituality, she's coming in to share anxiety. But of course, all these things pile up over the other. And then I wanted to tell something more positive, And yes, I was so lucky to be a few times in Brazil, where I was usually with what we know about Brazil is football and dancing, but they have some amazing spiritual places where one is cared with so much love and put in beautiful bed clothes and really cared with so much care, completely free of charge. And I've seen people doing the kind of job that you are reminding us that our job can be a ritual of care and receiving other in the healing.
Thank you. Gentlemen, you.
Ewan, thank you very much for that.
Sorry, I can't see you. Sorry.
I'm here.
Hi.
Thank you for that great presentation. Mine is a very brief question, and it's a theoretical question. I was wondering about the frameworks on which you draw for developing understanding of the meaning and practice of ritual. And in particular, I would be interested to know whether you draw on anthropology, because I think it's there, within that discipline, that we find a lot of in-depth understanding and knowledge about the practice and meaning of ritual. Because I didn't see any anthropologists on your side.
No, but you're absolutely right. I have dipped into some anthropology, sociologists and pastoral theologians. So those would be my main. Be lovely. I'd love to have a discussion over a drink. That'd be great.
Thank you, Dr. Carey. My name is Kurt Weiss. I'm a sociologist from Munich in Germany, and I would just like to, not to ask a question, just to comment on your last question. With whom does the power lie? Yes, that is a very important question with rituals. But you might even look at life as an endless row of endless rituals. And this issue, with whom does the power lie, is a very important issue of how to get along with all other life beings around, not only limited to these sad cases that you were talking about. It's a very important question for the whole life. With whom does the power lie? How do we handle other people? And thank you for that last question.
Very quickly, I think all of this is a process, and for me there are what I might call formal ritual moments, but life every day there are informal ritual moments that we construct with others, and with whom does the power lie? Thank you.